I try to schedule a sermon at least once a year or so for at least two reasons. First, it's important to learn about the world's second largest religion. There are approximately 1.6 billion Muslims in the world compared with around 2.1 billion Christians. And the statistics I've seen, the latest ones, that Islam is scheduled to overtake Christianity by around 2070 and become the world's largest religion. A second reason that I try to preach at least once a year about Islam is that there is a lot of Islamophobic misinformation out there that needs to be corrected. I'll limit myself this morning to just a few examples. For instance, contrary to the popular stereotypes that all Muslims are Arab terrorists, most Muslims are neither terrorists nor terrorist sympathizers, and most Muslims aren't Arab. Only 20% of Muslims are Arabs. And the countries with the largest Muslim populations, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, Nigeria, those are all democracies, which counters the myth that Islam is incompatible with democracy. Furthermore, Saudi Arabia has only the 16th largest Muslim population, behind countries such as Uzbekistan, Ethiopia, Turkey, and Iran. For what it's worth, Saudi Arabia's Muslim population is approximately equivalent to China's Muslim population. The huge number of Muslims outside of the Middle East shows both the diversity of Islam in the present as well as hope for an increasingly pluralistic Islam in the future. Along those lines, my sermon title for this morning is inspired by the book Misquoting Muhammad, The Challenge and the Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy by Dr. Jonathan A.C. Brown, who's an associate professor of Islamic Studies and Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. He's particularly interesting to me because he operates at a three-way intersection between his personal experience as a practicing Muslim, his deep immersion in the classical Islamic interpretive tradition, and his commitment to modern Western methods of scholarship. I appreciate his willingness, for example, to use the provocative title, Misquoting Muhammad, as well as his subtitle, which is equally important, The Challenges and the Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy. Because whether we're talking about Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, Darwin, or Freud, there are challenges and choices to be made in interpreting the legacies of such world historical figures. To go ahead and make my position clear from the outset, given what we know here in the 21st century, it is insufficient to blame one's prejudice, one's sexism, heterosexism, racism, or classism on historical figures or documents. You know, to say, I don't want to believe this. I don't want to be racist or classist or sexist, but the Bible made me do it. You know, it's what we call picking out clobber texts and then beating people over the head with it. We must each take responsibility for the impact of our interpretive choices, or the interpretive choices of the communities of which we are a part. Now, it used to be easier to make an argument that, you know, I'm just holding a certain opinion because the sacred scriptures tell me to. But over the years, close readings have both traced the complicated history of transmitting those sacred teachings from when they were originally made, which have introduced periodic changes to the original. They've also exposed the limited historical context in which any teachings are originally given, making it questionable to try to apply them to all times and places in some sort of simplistic way, even if we had an unadulterated copy of the original, which we do not in any of the cases. And there's a lot to say about the history of all of the world's religions, but I'll limit myself for this morning to setting a stage for considering misquoting Muhammad by briefly comparing the ways that people have also misquoted Moses and misquoted Jesus. One of the traditional ways of the importance of the Torah that it was defended is that these first five books of the Bible that make up the Torah, you're all with me, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, right? You can check your pew Bibles. Right? So that the reason they were considered authoritative is it was said that Moses, this great leader of the Israelite people, was understood to have written them. But one of the first loose strings that people began to tug on, that began to unravel the story of Mosaic authorship. So you can sometimes think of that word text as related to the word textile, fabrics. The texts are often like that. The way we choose to unravel a textile is very similar to how you can begin to unravel how a text came together. That one of the first strings that people began to pull on was noticing that at the very end of the Torah, in Deuteronomy chapter 34, that it describes Moses' death and burial. And people begin to say, wait a second, how does it talk about his funeral? Now, you can do some interpretive gymnastics to explain that, but that started to give people permission to ask some hard questions. And centuries of further study discovered increasing numbers of loose threads that made it clear eventually that the Torah was stitched together from at least four documents that have been woven together, and of course that themselves were products of oral history over time from various settings, and that none of them came into their final form until many centuries after Moses' death, likely during the Babylonian exile. If you're curious to learn more, two accessible introductions are Who Wrote the Bible? And The Bible with Sources Revealed, both written by Richard Elliott Friedman. That Bible with Sources Revealed shows in different colors and bold and italics the different strands of how the Hebrew Bible, the Torah in particular, were woven together. And the Bible, and Who Wrote the Bible, sort of tells this history of the Hebrew Bible, almost like a murder mystery, like a whodunit story that goes back and reconstructs it. Turning to misquoting Jesus, I highly recommend Bart Ehrman's book by that same name, which is what inspired this book on Islam, Misquoting Muhammad. Because Jesus, like Moses, like Muhammad, did not write down his own teachings. Laura talked about the ways that Muhammad was thought to be, and probably was, illiterate. And that was sort of this parallel to the Virgin Mary in Christianity. You know, Mary had to be a virgin and couldn't have original sin so that Jesus wouldn't have original sin. You know, it was like Muhammad had to be illiterate so that it was thought that these were revelations from beyond him that were then recorded by other people, as the legends go. And so Jesus didn't write down his own teachings. Instead, it is the Gospel of Mark, written decades after Jesus, that is the earliest writings that we have of his teachings, that we have a copy of. Moreover, if you look closely at almost any version of the Bible, you'll see, and I'm not talking about the annotations, kind of the scholarly commentary. If you look, there's often really tiny footnotes that say things like, other manuscripts say, on almost every page of the Bible. Because we do not have the originals for any sacred scriptures, and often these manuscripts disagree with one another. And just to take the case of the Christian scriptures, if you add up all those instances of other manuscripts say, the best estimate is there are between 300,000 and 400,000 textual variants among the manuscripts. Yet there are only about 140,000 words in the New Testament. Now, of course, the variants, not all words have equal numbers of variants, of course, and there's a lot more to be said. And in all fairness, I should hasten to add that the vast majority of those 300,000 to 400,000 discrepancies are minor. Many, many of them are just misspellings. Less than 1% of the variants are potentially meaningful for our understanding and our interpretation of the New Testament, and that's what Ehrman does for the most part in Misquoting Jesus, is he takes the most interesting of those 1% and kind of explores them for you. But the situation of manuscript transmission is quite different in Islam. So in Christianity, we have four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as well as the non-canonical Gospels of Mary and Thomas and Judas and others. So you have a lot of according tos that were written over the years. With Islam, about 20 years after Muhammad's death, one formalized official copy of the Quran was made. So they gathered all the recitations, all the prayers, all the scattered parchments of Muhammad's followers and made one formalized official copy. So they kind of took all the oral tradition. That the Quran was actually often memorized, still is often memorized. You'll sometimes see someone who's a Muslim called a Hafiz, H-A-F-I-Z. That's someone who as a child memorized the Quran is a Hafiz. And if you've never read the Quran before, there are ways in which it's much more accessible than the Bible in that it is much shorter. So it's about four-fifths the length of the New Testament. So if you take a Bible, that much is the New Testament, that much is the Hebrew Bible. So the Quran is just four-fifths the length of the New Testament. So that can make it more accessible. But there are other ways in which the Quran is more difficult to be accessed by newcomers. Particularly, the text is non-linear. It's 114 chapters, or what are called surahs, are not arranged in chronological, narrative, or thematic order. Rather, they are arranged from the longest one to the shortest one. So, and it's just in general a more poetic and lyrical work. It's just a very different sort of book than the Bible, and people that bring these sort of expectations to it that grew up in a Christian or Jewish tradition are often just sort of confounded by, this isn't like the Christian tradition at all. No, it's not. It's different. And if you're interested in studying the Quran for yourself, it's notable that HarperCollins is publishing a new study Quran next month with a lot of accompanying introductory essays, explanatory annotations parallel to their best-selling study Bible. But as significant as the Quran is to the Islamic tradition, also of great importance are the Hadith, which are collections of the Prophet Muhammad's sayings and actions. Hadith is from the Arabic word for report, account, or narrative. So if you want to compare, like, the Jewish tradition has, like, the Talmud and the Gemara, these traditions that built up over time that are much longer than the Hebrew scripture. For example, the Muslim practice of praying five times daily, the details of how do you actually fast during Ramadan, that's not in the Quran, that's in the Hadith. And unlike the Quran, for which one definitive version was made 20 years after Muhammad's death, with the Hadith, reports of the prophet's words and deeds were forged by the thousands. Some of them are authentic, some of them are not, so it's a lot trickier, greatly increasing the likelihood with the Hadith of misquoting Muhammad. And although there's much more to say about the complex traditions that are developed around interpreting some of the clear internal contradictions of the Quran, in which later revelations to Muhammad are usually understood to trump, or the word they use is abrogate, earlier sayings that may be in conflict with later sayings, there's also a lot to be said about the complex interpretive traditions that have built up around the Hadith, around which ones do you have to follow, and there's kind of a spectrum, and which ones are authentic. What I want to be sure to take time to address this morning is the even more important issue of how do we interpret the Quran responsibly today. And one fascinating dynamic of the intersection of Islam as well as Christianity with the modern world is the significant increase we've seen since the situation in the ancient world of individuals interpreting scripture in isolation, outside of either a community of interpreters and often without any training in the traditions of interpretation that have developed over the centuries. At its most damaging, the result is someone like Osama bin Laden proof texting using isolated, out of context verses and oversimplified interpretations, really idiosyncratic interpretations that are a surprise to anyone that has studied the centuries of Islamic interpretations, using those to justify horrific acts of violence, which really should be seen as being done in Osama bin Laden's name, but which he tries to say are being done in Islam's name. But it's important to keep in mind that the Christian tradition, for example, as well, has of course been used to inspire tremendous acts of forgiveness and mercy and love and compassion. But it's also been used to justify acts of terror, the Inquisition, the Crusades, which only strengthens my conviction that the responsibility for one's interpretation is on the individual and or the community of interpretation much more so than the text in question. So when I hear the common diagnosis that Islam just needs a Muslim Martin Luther, I think that the situation is actually much more complicated than that. There's a lot to be said about Luther as well, but just to make one point, one of Luther's main teachings was called sola scriptura, that the Bible, that we should interpret Christianity through scripture alone. But in retrospect, we can see the ways that which, in questioning the authority of the Roman Catholic Pope through the Protestant Reformation, Luther ended up making out of the Bible a paper pope, which still didn't get us back to actually following what Jesus said or did. The Bible still has to be interpreted, even if you take the hierarchy of religious leaders out of the question. And then you have the even more potentially volatile situation of individuals with no accountability interpreting the Bible, which can be good or bad. The much more important change needed than a Muslim Martin Luther is a shift toward pragmatism, making people responsible for the fruit, the result of their engagement with sacred scripture. Because if your interpretation increases hate and fear and inequality and violence in the world, then the problem is much more with you than with the book you are reading. I would make the same argument in support of reading banned books. The problem is much less the text than whether we are teaching the practice of reading responsibly, what has been called the need to practice safe texts. And behind the question of interpretation is that question of authority. And the more progressive or theologically liberal you are, the less troubled you are by passages of Scripture that are offensive to modern understandings of gender and sexuality and class, and the more willing you are to simply dismiss those passages as obsolete. As many of you have heard me say before, the liberal turn in theology is the move from authority vested in religious hierarchy and in ancient myths about supposedly infallible revelations from above, and the move toward authority vested in reason, what is logical, and authority vested in experience, what you know to be true either firsthand for yourself or because it's been proven through the scientific method. From the perspective of Unitarian Universalism, Islam is part of our third source, wisdom from the world's religions, which inspires our ethical and our spiritual life. But our tendency is to let go of the passages that no longer seem relevant to our globalized, pluralistic, and postmodern age. Our opening hymn this morning, "Where is Our Holy Church," is a strong example of this sort of theologically liberal bent of interpreting religion. Our Holy Church is not merely buildings such as this one, as beautiful it is as it is, but wherever people are gathered for the free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Our Holy Writ is not merely an ancient document, but each person's direct experience of transcending mystery and wonder. Our Holy One is not a being out there somewhere, but movements of people led by the transforming spirit of love to confront powers and structures of evil with justice and with compassion. Our Holy Land is not a piece of geography, but the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. And our paradise is not first and foremost a hope in a next world, but working for justice and equity and compassion here and now, in this world. In that spirit, I will conclude with the following words from the progressive theologian Brian McLaren. He writes that there are two kinds of Christianity, along with two kinds of Islam and Judaism and every other religion and non-religion too. One of social control and one of social transformation. One to hold people down and one to lift them up. One, an opiate to pacify people into compliance, the other a stimulant to empower people to imagine a better world, a better future, a better life, giving them the courage to live in peaceful defiance of violent, corrupt, and greedy powers that be. Neither kind is perfect, and both kinds contain good and sincere people. But if those who use God and religion for social control are left to divine religion, then the religion they define will be a false one, an ugly one, an idolatrous one. May we lend our hearts, our hands, our minds, our wills to create a movement of social transformation, to lift people up, to empower them to imagine a better world, to join in solidarity, to challenge injustice.